ever since the horrific events of 9/11, 2001, Americans have become painfully aware of the threat of Islamic extremism and Islamic terrorism. For many, the fear of terrorism on our own soil is a constant. And recently, a rather crude, but what would have been effective car bomb was discovered in New York's Times Square, dismantled before it exploded. And of course, there was the incident of the so-called underwear bomber apprehended at the Detroit airport. So the reality of Islamic terrorism is one that Americans now share with Israelis, who of course have had to endure more than a decade of suicide bombers and other forms of militant attacks on their civilian population. At the same time, among the American people, and certainly within the Obama administration, there is an effort to understand what the Islamic world is all about and to become as sophisticated as possible in analyzing the real threats which face the United States and the State of Israel. And so I'm especially pleased to welcome now one of the world's foremost experts on Middle East affairs, especially in the area of Islamic terrorism, Dr. Daniel Pipes, the founder and director of the Middle East Forum, a nonprofit think tank based in Philadelphia that works to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. And Daniel Pipes is also the founder of Campus Watch, which critiques academics writing about the Middle East. Daniel Pipes has spent more than two-thirds of his life studying the Middle East. He knows Arabic. He's traveled the Muslim world, living 3 years in Cairo, has taught courses on the Middle East at Harvard, and has served as a special advisor on the Middle East and terrorism at both the U.S. State and Defense Departments. Daniel has written more than a dozen books, and his opinion pieces often appear in the National Review and in newspapers across the globe. And in 2003, President Bush nominated Dr. Pipes to the board of directors of the U.S. Institute of Peace. And Daniel Pipes, thank you so much for joining us and giving us some time today.
Thank you for the invitation.
From your perspective, how real now is the Islamic threat on American soil?
It's considerable. The authorities are finding and exposing new threats on a monthly basis, perhaps. And these are fairly large-scale ones. In addition, there are smaller ones, which are taking place here and there, the murder of a military recruiter, an attack on a Jewish center that don't get much attention. So it's ongoing.
To what extent is Islamic extremism focused first or primarily on Israel, and the extent to which the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is the source of the sore which drives Islamic extremism?
There's no question that the Arab-Israeli conflict is an aggravating factor. If that were solved tomorrow, the whole thing just done away with, the problem no longer there, however resolved, and just no more Arab-Israeli conflict, there would be one less issue. But there are a whole lot of issues. I mean, Kashmir is a big issue, too, and plenty of others around the world, Chechnya, and so forth and so on. So, yes, it is an irritant, but take it away, and the situation's not that different. There's no way you can say that Islamists in Indonesia and Nigeria and all over the world are all obsessed about what's taking place in the Arab-Israeli conflict. No.
But you hear this all the time, Daniel, that there's this notion that if only the Israeli-Palestinian conflict could be solved, the issues dealing between West and the Muslim world also would be solved.
Yeah.
Is there truth to that, or
it's called
that a fiction?
There's a name for it. It's called linkage.
And what do you think of the linkage?
I think it's ridiculous. Again, you asked on the Islamic question, then we can look at it in the Middle East.
So, yes.
You know, Syria, Libya, Iraq, Iran. Would everything be fine if the Arab-Israeli conflict was solved? Obviously not. Israel is the Zionist movement initially, and now Israel is a force for good, whether it be economic, created opportunities, caused a stream of Arabs to come into Palestine and then Israel, still today, I mean, there's still a stream of Muslims, Arabs, coming into Israel, be they Kurds at the northern border, Africans at the southern border, wanting to come into Israel for economic opportunity, for freedom, and so forth. It is also a righteous country that follows the law and so forth. So Israel in itself is a good thing. The Middle East is a blighted region from autocracy and corruption and drought to misogyny and brutality and cruelty and economic backwardness and so forth. I mean, you name it, the Middle East suffers from it. And it's kind of curious to blame all that on the one successful country in the region, or the most successful country. It's a little reversing the problem. No, Israel's not to blame for that. And the solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, well, obviously good for all concerned, will hardly fix things in Afghanistan, will hardly fix things in Sudan, will hardly fix things in Egypt, or for that matter, in Gaza.
What's the ultimate goal of the Islamic extremist, Daniel? And you have made a distinction in your writings between what you call the Islamic extremist, who you define as the problem, and then you talk about the Islamic moderate, who you say may be the solution. But begin with the Islamic extremist. What's their real goal?
The goal is twofold. One is what I call autonomism, which is control of territory.
Territory?
Yeah, by Muslims. And two is what I call legalism, which is applying the law.
Mm-hmm.
So, say the Arab effort against Israel is autonomism. This is territory that was historically under Muslim law. We want to rule it now. But it doesn't have to be historically under Muslim law. Britain, you'll hear these voices saying, Britain should be a Muslim country. There should be a Muslim in 10 Downing Street.
Mm-hmm.
So that's control of territory. And the second is legalism, overthrowing the Shah. The Shah was a Muslim, but getting rid of him replaced a nominal Muslim with an Ayatollah Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Applying the law, or Arafat was a nominal Muslim. You get rid of him and Mahmoud Abbas, and you put in Hamas, which is a real Islamist Muslim. So those are the two things.
If you were today advising the Obama administration, what's the biggest mistake they're making?
That's a good one. Well, there are a lot of them. In the Cold War, the right was more fearful of the Soviet Union, and the left was less so. Believed that there was an ability to co-opt and work with. Well, interestingly enough, you see the same mentalities today.
Is one more right than the other?
Well, I'm on this side, I'll tell you. It's the right side. It was certainly right with the communists, and I believe it's no less correct today. This is a tremendous menace. But the left tends not to see it that way. There's a pattern in the non-Muslim world, not speaking about Turkey and Egypt and Pakistan, but in the non-Muslim world, India, Canada, Australia, here, of the left working with the Islamists. And while there are many reasons for it, the most important one is that both of them don't like the existing order. The left doesn't like capitalism, and the Muslims, the Islamists, don't like the Christian-based civilization. Very different approaches, but they agree on the fact they don't like the existing order, and so they work together. And so when 9/11 happened, you had the far left exalting. Finally, somebody's done something. Did it for the wrong reasons in the wrong way, maybe, but they did something. And so you have this emotional coming together, and you see it so many times. You see it over and over again. I mean, one illustration would be the Iranian-Venezuelan axis that's emerged between Hugo Chavez and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Or you'll see George Galloway in Britain, far, far, far left politician, having essentially a pro-Muslim party.
The left tends to explain things this way. America has been very much self-absorbed. America has only cared about American interests, does not realize the extent to which it uses the world's natural resources in a disproportionate fashion, and has been in some way enslaving other parts of the world, either with intent or by policy that spills over. And as a result, the third world and underprivileged countries are simply the victims of an American, again, hubris.
Right. And that lays the basis for working together.
And therefore, it is necessary not to make the Muslim world the enemy, but to understand their grievances and to realize the extent to which we in the West are responsible in some part for generating a 9/11 response to us, and that they then look at a Barack Obama who comes in as president and says, the first thing I'm going to do is reach out to the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. And in some way, not to the Muslim extremists necessarily, but to the Muslim world in general, say to them, we are now more cognizant of our own failures in this regard, and we want to be more open to embracing what is good about you and creating some kind of new world order.
You got it.
You've
now,
heard this.
Yeah. Now, what's so striking is that the Obama administration's been in office now for something over a year, and it's not worked. Not worked. The results are poor. You don't see a spike in popularity for the United States. You don't see terrorist efforts diminishing. You don't see Islamist propaganda against us diminishing. It's not working. In fact, you see continuity. And if, say, George Bush had shoes thrown at him in Baghdad, Barack Obama's had his effigy burnt in Kabul. And when, for example, he was awarded the Nobel Prize last year, there was hooting and cackling in places like Iraq and Palestinian territories. You know, what's he done? You know, who is he? So, no, I don't think it's working. You've certainly got the American approach, but the Muslim response has been anything but favorable.
Okay, I want to come back, because it's not that you dodged, but you didn't give me a full enough answer. I said to you, what is it that the Obama administration really gets wrong here? And if you were advising them, what are some of the things you'd want to correct about their attitude towards the Islamic problem in general?
Well, you kept encapsulated in your presentation. What they get wrong is this notion that the United States is to blame, that we are at fault, that we have caused the problems of the world, that if it weren't for us, things would be better. I would reverse that and say that we have improved things. I've traveled a lot, and time after time in different countries I've said, huh, this is a democracy because of the United States. Well, it's a decent country because of the United States. It's a very different point of view. Now, we're not angels. We've made plenty of mistakes. But the record is a very, very impressive one. I'll give you just one example. You know, throughout history, the victor in war plundered the loser as late as World War I. World War II, we changed it. We didn't plunder the loser. We gave money to the losers. And look what the results were. Phenomenal. And we've changed the nature of warfare because now it's expected. You go fight in Afghanistan. You go fight in Iraq. You don't just fight them and take their, you know, the good things, their wealth. You go there and you spend your wealth. We've now spent close to $50 billion in Iraq on non-military expenditures. Not talking about our military, but spending money in Iraq itself, $50 billion. You know, we've been giving $3 billion or so to the Israelis a year. That pales in consideration. This is on the order of $6 billion a year we're spending in Iraq on infrastructure and social organizations and so forth. I mean, this is an amazing change. This is an American invention. I don't think it's working terribly well in Iraq, but nonetheless, the effort is extraordinary. And that's a Bush administration effort. I'm against it, actually. I mean, on a tactical level, I don't think it's a good idea. But
it meaning?
On a moral, this spending of money and trying to rehabilitate Iraq, but on a moral level, it's extraordinary, extraordinary. And that's an American achievement.
How have you, Daniel Pipes, viewed the American administration's attempt to bring the Israelis and the Palestinians to the peace table?
There's a war between the Arabs and Israel. It's a war that's been going on for 60-odd years. And there are two possible resolutions of this war. One is that Israel wins and is accepted by the Arabs. And the other is that the Arabs win and there is no Israel. That's not to say that there are no Jews living there. Maybe not. Maybe they'll be thrown out. But maybe they'll be accepted there as a subject population. I don't know what it would be, but there's no Israel. There's a Palestine run by Muslims. And Jews are in some
Those are the two alternatives.
Those are two alternatives. That is the resolution of the conflict. I don't think there's any other. I don't think finding some line in the...
Yes, you've written against the two-state solution.
Well, yes, I have. Let me just give you a little more background. Therefore, I think either Israel wins or Israel loses. I think it's that stark. And I would say that the history of the last close to 40 years of negotiations since 1973 show that that negotiations don't work. I don't see the Egyptian negotiations as a success. I see Egypt as this ever-growing conventional force power.
I'm sorry. Are you saying you do not believe that the Israeli-Egyptian peace has been worth it to Israel?
I think it's a disaster.
Really?
Disaster. I mean, if you compare Egypt and Syria, Egypt has a peace treaty, Syria doesn't. Neither of them have had a hot war since 1973. And yet the Egyptians, by virtue of having a peace treaty, have all the American arms they can dream of and are building and building and building, spending huge amounts on a military, conventional military force. Against whom? Sudan? Libya?
Are you worried about a future war between
Egypt
and Israel?
Absolutely. Where the Syrians have floundered because they lost their Soviet patron and don't have an American patron and are very weak. And if you look at polling in Egypt, it's more antagonistic to Israel than I would imagine polling in Syria would be. We don't really have any. But it's incredibly antagonistic. Over 90% see Israel as an enemy. Only 2-3% believe it's a friend. So, in other words, having an unelected president sign some document, which we in the old days assumed would lead to a shift, a change of heart, has not done so. I don't think these compromises work. I think
interesting. You know, this is such unconventional thinking within the Jewish world, and even in whenever you hear Israeli politicians speak, Israeli politicians tend to always say, "And look, we have peace with Egypt and peace with Jordan."
Yeah, right. Peace. Peace means there are two kinds of peace, as Immanuel Kant pointed out. There's the peace like we have with Canada, where we have no issues, and there's deterrent peace, where it's too costly to engage in war, and that's the kind of peace that a piece of paper being signed, isn't it? What you need is a change of heart. What you need is acceptance of Israel, which does not yet exist in large numbers. What you see is about 20% of the Arab population, Muslim population even, Palestinian population, accepting Israel. It's not
only 20%.
It's not nothing. It's not like it's 100% hostile. There is a base, and today it's very important in terms of intelligence gathering. So it's not negligible, but it is small. It has always been oppressed. It's always been the 80% that dominate. And what I say is that the goal has to be to get that 20% to 60%, which nobody's trying to do now. What they're trying to do is form some kind of proximity talks that lead to some kind of negotiation, that lead to some kind of compromise, some kind of painful concession on the Israeli part. Hopeless. There's a long record of being hopeless. The only way this conflict's going to end is when the Palestinians give up, or, for that matter, the Israelis give up. I hope the Palestinians will give up, and they'll allow this successful modern country to go its own way, and instead the Palestinians will tend to their own garden and build their own polity and culture and society and economy and leave the Israelis alone.
But not in the context of a two-state solution.
No. Well, I have no objection in theory to a two-state solution if the Palestinians were truly to give up their foul, irredentist dreams of destroying Israel and tend to their own garden. And they're not Jordanians, and they're not Egyptians, and they have their own Palestine. No objection in principle. But I think the historical record shows that the Palestinians are unable to do this in a responsible way, are incapable, extremist, incompetent, anarchic, violent. And in contrast, the Jordanian and Egyptian governments are better. And so I would prefer to have, for the time being anyway, for a long time to come, in fact, a Jordanian and Egyptian rule. The Jordanians are quite eager to go back to the West Bank. The Egyptians are very reluctant to go back to Egypt, but I think that's...
You mean Gaza?
Gaza. But I think in the interim, that's the most viable solution.
Okay. And is there anything on the horizon which suggests that your view, not a two-state solution, but basically the Palestinians on the West Bank be absorbed into Jordan, and Jordan once again controls the West Bank, and there are two states, Jordan and Israel. Is there anything that leads you to believe that that is in the offing?
Well, the Jordanians are eager for it. But the more profound question really is not so much this alternative to the two-state solution. Is there anything I would have you ask of me? Is there anything to suggest that the Israelis, Americans, and others are giving up on diplomacy. No, it's still there. It's the holy grail of democratic politics because of linkage. You solve this, and the Middle East is fixed. But it's not working. We've had, in particular, 16 years since 1993, and it's a disaster. Everything is worse than it was in 1993. So I ask, how much longer does this have to go on until someone starts thinking of an alternative to going back and trying ever again to have a Palestinian-Israeli diplomatic solution? It's not working. Mm-hmm. I mean, things were much better in 1993 than today.
Since Oslo, it has all gone downhill in your mind.
People tend to think of the Palestinians as supermen, that they alone cannot be defeated. They have a will that is beyond that
yes,
of anyone
else.
Yes,
it's their will.
To which I say, you know, the Germans lost, the Japanese lost, we lost in 1975. Great powers lose, and the Palestinians are immutable, and they always have this will. No, they have this will because they believe they can win. And the goal has to be to convince them you can't win. This is unwinnable. You have lost. And unfortunately, there's nobody in, there's no effort today in the United States, or more importantly in Israel, to try and convey that message. There's no attempt to do that. And there's no attempt to get the 20% who accept Israel to grow and grow and grow. None. What you find is a universal consensus that, quite universal, but widespread consensus, that the Palestinians have already reached that accommodation,
That's correct.
It's already happened.
Right.
And I say, oh yeah? Show me. Show me in elections, show me in polls, show me in anecdotes, show me. Show me what this acceptance of Israel is. I don't see it. I see one-fifth.
So do you believe that there is a Mahmoud Abbas who would, if he had the power, create a Palestinian state that would live side by side with the state of Israel for all eternity?
I believe there are a not tiny, not trivial percentage of Palestinians who are ready to live side by side with Israel.
And is Abbas one of them?
Since the 1920s? No, definitely not. Absolutely not.
Why not?
Well, he comes out of the structure.
There are many people who argue both Abbas and Fayyad are two examples of Palestinian leaders who, if they did not have to deal with Hamas and a little bit of Hezbollah, but basically Hamas, if they didn't have to deal with Hamas, they could make peace because their mentality has changed. And you say?
I don't see any change in mentality. I see them saying one thing for the West and Israel and another thing to their own people. It's no different from Yasser Arafat. They are two-faced, and they will, you know, shake hands. I mean, the difference between Abbas and Hamas, between the PLO and Hamas, is one of tactics, whether you deal with Israel or not, is one of ideology, whether you're Islamist or not, is one of international orientation, whether you work with the Iranians or not, one of personnel. Lots of differences. But what they don't differ on is what the goal is, and the goal is elimination of Israel. So I call them the good terrorists and the bad terrorists. And I don't really care for the good terrorists any more than I care for the bad terrorists.
So
awash.
Netanyahu is making a mistake when he says now, we will meet with no preconditions and sit with Abbas to work on a two-state solution.
Well, Netanyahu is not like me, a commentator. Netanyahu is a politician who has to deal with the American government and his own faction and the coalition and so forth. So he has imperatives. So I'm not so much criticizing him as saying, I wish the U.S. government, which I have a voice in, stop this perpetual pressure for Israel to make concessions. Mm-hmm. And instead say, hey, Israel, win your war. You're our ally. These people are our enemies. Defeat them.
Why doesn't the U.S. say that?
Because there is a hope to solve through diplomacy, the Arab-Israeli conflict that will be neat and clean and no use of force and everybody's happy. I mean, it's I completely agree.
Okay,
it's
a more desirable
outcome.
It is
it's
driven by idealism.
I wish that negotiations would lead to resolution. Given a choice between that and winning a war, I'd say, yeah, nicer to negotiate than to win a war. But I have come to the conclusion, and I used to believe in this, when Sadat signed with Begin, I was
euphoric. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the conflict was more or less ending. Mm-hmm. Well, I learned my lesson. I was not euphoric when Arafat signed with Rabin. I was very skeptical. And I'm more and more skeptical. Yeah, these pieces of paper mean nothing to me now. I dismiss them out of hand. So I've learned over 30-some years to the realities of it. It's not pieces of paper. It's not statements for the international press. It's what's in people's hearts, Arab, Muslim, Palestinian hearts. And that's the goal, is to change that. And that's the goal, is to say, look, you can't win. The goal is an Israeli victory. I just published a piece recently called My Peace Plan, an Israeli victory. That's what leads to peace.
And you would like to see the United States
back Israel.
Back Israel in that regard. Daniel, who is, in your understanding, the circle around President Obama who gives him his Middle East information?
Well, first, the Obama administration is very closed. It's hard to get information. But what appears to be the case is that there are two factions. There's one faction which I'll call the conventional Democratic faction, like Bill Clinton, and indeed has lots of holdovers from the Clinton era, like Dennis Ross and George Mitchell and Hillary Clinton, who argue for good relations with Israel in order to get Israel to make concessions.
In order for them to make concessions.
Exactly. And then you've got what might be called the Netroots, which want to fight with Israel.
Who are they?
They tend to be less prominent.
But you gave me names on one side. Can you
give
me names
others,
on the other?
The others are more difficult to
identify,
but a deputy of George Mitchell's by the name of Myra Rudman. It appears that Emmanuel is in this.
Why
category.
Would Rahm Emanuel, who has Israeli roots?
Because a lot of Israelis who think the same way. You remember the famous statement by the Haaretz editor speaking to Condoleezza Rice? He said, rape us?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not that unusual in Israel. So you have these two factions. One saying, work with Israel in order to get Israeli concessions. One saying, fight with Israel in order to get Israeli concessions. And I think the Ross camp is correct. But at times, the Netroot camp wins.
And what are you calling this?
The what? Netroot.
Netroot.
Yeah, you know, far left. The N-E-T-R-O-O-T.
Netroot, okay. Yeah.
Central left and far left. It's not exactly...
Both sides.
I would also say James Jones is in the second category,
okay. But
he's not far left. Those who want to fight with Israel and those who don't. The key point I'm trying to make is that there are two different interpretations. Now, I tend to think that I prefer the Ross approach. I prefer the... be friendly to Israel approach, but I don't like the consequences of it, which is that the Israelis make really stupid moves. And when the fighting with Israel faction dominates, the Israelis clench and close and say no. And so in some ways, I mean, you can say there's a silver lining to this, or in some ways there are benefits to this fighting with Israel approach, because the Israelis don't make the same, from my point of view, the same mistakes. So it's very complex. Relationship. I think the ultimate challenge to Israel is not Iran, although it's a huge one, and not the Palestinians, external Palestinians like Gaza and West Bank Palestinians. The ultimate challenge to Israel are the domestic Palestinians, who constitute some 20% Muslims, for the most part.
Are we talking about Arab Israelis?
Yeah. Who began their career in Israel very quiet. Increasingly assertive and disloyal and don't like the existence of a Jewish state. When you ask there, what does Israel do? I'm a bit stumped and they come up with some ideas. But in contrast, I have a very clear notion of how Israel defeats its external Palestinian enemy. But I don't know what Israel does with this internal enemy, which cannot be defeated in their citizens. How does it make them loyal? Does it change boundary lines? I mean, there's nothing sacrosanct about the 1949 armistice lines. They can be changed. You can have Maale Adonim within Israel. You can have Om al-Fam in some kind of Palestinian entity. I don't know. But that I think, is the really challenging long-term problem for Israel, more so than Gaza and the West Bank.
Daniel Pipes, I could sit with you forever. I appreciate so much the sophisticated analysis you bring to this, which we normally don't get to hear. And I've told you this off camera as well. You are a very special person, and that you've allowed me to talk to you over the years has been very, very kind, and I appreciate it. I hope you'll allow me to put a semicolon here and not a period, and that we will continue this in the future. Daniel Pipes, thank you. Thank you. And those were the thoughts of Dr. Daniel Pipes, the founder and director of the Middle East Forum and of Campus Watch. And whether you agreed with everything he had to say or not, I hope you enjoyed meeting him. As always, I invite you to be in touch with me with any thoughts or comments you might have to the ideas expressed by Daniel Pipes. Please email me or write me this week. And if you'd like to be in touch with Dr. Pipes yourself, you can do so by emailing me, and I will pass your emails on to him. And so until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Be well, my friends.